Welcome to episode 15 of Coffee with Centuro. Good to be here. We've got Zan and Ben from Centuro Global, and we have another Ben. We like our Ben so much, we thought we'd get another one. And we've got Ben Caligari. Is that how you say it?
And that would be the Italian name to say it. I'm third generation. We say Caligari. I could care less.
Caligari. Okay. So Ben is with Code for America. He's out in Silicon Valley, I believe. Is that San Jose? Ben, is that where you're at?
The company's based in San Francisco, but I'm actually home with my family in New Hampshire on the East Coast for the time being. Okay. Hide out from COVID.
Nice. And we're gonna touch on working from anywhere, working from home, and all of that. But since we've got our American guest with, I thought we would jump straight into what by now is an election that has had almost everything in it. And since we've got our own resident American with us, let's ask you, what has been your impression of like what's happening over there? Can I just put it as bluntly as that?
Sure, you absolutely can. I think that's a very valid framing of that question. This has been one for the books with truly the most, I think every election we try to, both sides go into and say this election is the most important election in recent history, just to really drum up people's support as they can. But I really do think this one does have a lot going on. We are still, believe it or not actually technically done counting all the votes in a couple of states. We do, I think, we're pretty fair to say, assuming the spurious legal arguments that the Trump administration is attempting do not go anywhere, which I don't think they will with the brain trust of Rudy Giuliani at the helm. Biden will be the president come January. What that means, though, is still a little bit up in the air, because with the Senate still a toss-up with two special elections going on in Georgia, that won't be decided until mid-January, that could really determine the fate of whatever happens in Biden's presidency. Should the two Democrats win those two Senate seats, it'll be a 50-50 tie in the Senate with the tie-breaking vote going to the Vice President Kamala Harris. If they do not win both of those and Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, maintains control, we're going to see probably a repeat of what happened in 2008. The Republicans, much to the chagrin of Biden and his administration, will not play ball with the Democrats because it worked very well for them last time. They obstructed everything. They told Obama and his cabinet explicitly, we will not work with you. We'll try. The explicit goal is to make him a one-term president. I think we're going to see the same thing here. They recognize that operating as obstructionists will enable them to come in 2022, sweep the House, improve on the gains they made in 2020, and just come right back into power. So there's a lot that hangs in the balance in January, but it's safe to say, given all the polls, we're really expecting Biden to walk away with this. Once again, the polls are just a little bit more fake news we have to deal with. It was a big failure for the Biden administration, for the Biden campaign, no question about it. The Democrats did not walk away with this with the sweeping mandate that I think that they expected. So,
yeah, and poor all of us around the world are sitting here waiting, watching with, you know, bated breath about what's going to happen. But for the rest of us that are not in America, what do we think? And also Ben, obviously, but what do you think? And it might be one of those tricky questions. What are the leadership lessons that we can take from this election? Because, and maybe the lessons are also in the counter, right? Like what not to do, But what do you think the leadership lessons we can take? Each of you choose one that you think we can find out of this election.
Yeah, it's a good question. I almost wonder if there is anything we should take away, or if it's something we should just put behind us and move forward with it. I'm not sure there's anything that sort of springs to mind other than maybe trying to lose gracefully. Or to know when to step down, and I guess in the business world, then that's when you start looking to pivot and so forth. But to have almost a plan ready for it and to know when to step down. But other than that, I'm not sure as much I'm going to take away and take into any of my leadership skills.
On the stepping down point, it'd probably actually be better for Trump to step down. I mean, I don't know about from a legal perspective because he gets protections from being president. I don't know what the consequences will be, whether people will prosecute him for various things. But I saw some statistics a few days ago. Can't remember off the top of my head, so don't quote me on them. But apparently Trump was worth something like $3.5 billion when on the day he was inaugurated. And today he's worth around $2.5 billion. I mean, that's a lot of money no matter what. But still, his worth has dropped by $1 billion. I mean, obviously he's lost out on numerous opportunities business-wise because of conflict of interest. Lost out on presenting or hosting The Apprentice, which apparently he made hundreds of millions in 12 years or however long it was. So surely by stepping down, he's had his run, he's in his 70s, like maybe go back to business, make loads more money. Isn't that what he's into anyway?
Yeah, I saw some slightly similar numbers, but I saw it go from 4 billion to 3. But the point of the article was in his favor because it then showed the value of all the other previous presidents, the Obamas and the Clintons, and all their values went up in tens of millions. So it's like at the start of the presidency, it's worth 700,000, a million, and now at the end of his presidency, it's worth 70 million or something. So that was the argument I saw, but in a similar vein. I have to imagine he'll then just be able to use this and have whatever number of supporters.
But what do you guys know about the fact that if Trump, before even he started his businesses, I mean, he is the biggest loser, right? Because besides losing the presidency, if he had taken all of his dad's money and just put it in the bank, he would have had more money than he had he would have had more money just from interest than all the money he's actually made in his business. So he's actually constantly losing. It's only the fact that he's got this delusions of grandeur that just kind of allows him to think that he's winning all the time.
I mean, I think you can make a pretty good argument that he's been doing pretty well. I mean, the fact that nobody has come calling on his, you know, massive hundreds of millions of dollars worth of debt is a really good case of what too big to fail looks like. I mean, I think what they recognize with this guy is he is best at marketing himself over anything else in his life. He's the best person in the world probably at doing that. And as long as he can keep that ball rolling and keep getting credit, they just hope to not be the last loser, whoever his debtors are. And that's worked out pretty well for him. Whether that will continue to be the case after he comes out of office is another question, but he's certainly more capable of it than anybody else in the world, I think.
I think it's going to be, I think coming out of office isn't going to slow him down from a marketing point of view, because everyone's going to want to know what he does next. Everybody's going to be hanging on his words still at that point to go, what's he doing now that he's not president? Like, he can literally just be like, this is my new venture. Now that I've been waiting to do this for 4 years, Biden can take the presidency. This is what I always wanted to do. He'll spin it back on him to being a positive, and then he'll say, this is my new thing. And people will, at least for a little while, but definitely I think in the immediate short term afterwards, lap it up. And he's got his followers and his army of supporters now. So,
yeah, I think back on your leadership point, Saraj, again, I don't know again if this has become a left versus right type thing, but there's a lot of things that Trump did or moves he made or things he said which felt like they were just for him to build up that following or that demographic of people that he knew would support him. And it was kind of, even though I'm the president of the US, you know, superpower, I'm going to make decisions that are better for me and that will get the support of this particular group of people. I mean, the basic things he did that you just think make no sense. Like, what was it? The climate, the Paris Climate Agreement. Let's just withdraw from that. Spend what, over a year? And it happened a couple of weeks ago, and now Biden's in. He's going to put America back in. So what a waste of time that all was, let alone the damage to the environment. I mean, that's surely protecting the planet is not a left versus right thing. That's just let's look out for the world. And then even human rights, even DACA, like he tried to get that ended, which was all about, you know, protecting immigrants, kids who came in who are now young adults, keeping them in their jobs, not being deported. I mean, just things like that. Surely you'd think, let's do it for the wider good, greater good. But because he knew there's a strong group of people that are against these things and you get that vote. I don't know if that's why he did it, but surely that's a poor form of leadership.
So my takeouts from this is just the fact that how a autocratic leader like him can just have a whole lot of followers around him. He clearly does not have, he only surrounds himself with yes men and probably no women, but just yes men, right? That's really what he surrounds himself with. And therefore, no one, there's supposedly all of this kind of talk about some people going up to him and tap him on the shoulder and saying, I think it's time to go, you know? But I don't think anyone is brave enough. And what I've noticed is that, you know, we've just come out of we had 9 years of a really corrupt president in South Africa, Jacob Zuma, who literally, the way he embedded his crew in all of the powerful places and the systematic looting of state coffers is at like monumental proportion. Billions and billions and billions of rands that have been stolen in this country where it could have been invested in the poor. And because he's at the top, it's almost like the fish rots from the head. I don't know if you've heard of that saying. And so therefore, everything else is also crooked. Then 2 years ago, we ousted him, got a really good president. And all of a sudden, it's all changing. And what I find is that it's the guy, there's some people who are always going to be good and some people always going to be bad. But there's a couple of guys in the middle who are looking, what's the leader doing? Which way can I lean? If the leader's corrupt, I'm definitely going to try and get away with it. And I think that's what worries me about leadership at this kind of level, where he's been there for 4 years. Some of the stuff he's doing by changing the Pentagon senior staff right now have got big consequences for a very long time, long after he's left.
I think the crux of what you're talking about, Siraj, with the sort of up and down the chain, closer to the head, the folks just start, you know, they read the tea leaves, they understand, I'm not going to be held accountable for this if I choose to take this action. It's less coercive than just an acknowledgement of the environment those folks are operating in. One thing that you think you have to look to is in 2008, when Obama took office, he said explicitly, after running a very anti-war campaign, railing against the Bush administration, you know, representing this great change in what people hoped America could become, immediately after getting into office, said with respect to the Bush administration and their various war crimes across the globe, that we should quote, look ahead and not behind. That really, I think, is the modern precedent for what we can expect as far as accountability for elected officials, at least in the United States. You know, Obama did not want to be held to the same standard as the Bush administration was in the public eye. He wanted to be able to do what he pleased, have the imprimatur of the state, and act with impunity in the way that those administrations did. Of course, Obama believed he was doing it for the right reasons, but I think the people of Libya, the people of Iraq, the people of Afghanistan probably have a different opinion on that. And so I believe Trump and his, you know, sort of entourage up and down the chain, you know, from the petty criminal, like, you know, stealing paper from the, you know, Department of Homeland Security to the, you know, the Michael Flynn's of the world working with Turkey behind the, you know, the backs of the government. They all, you know, maybe with the exception of Michael Flynn, they pretty much all recognize that the next administration is not going to put any effort into holding these people accountable, because for the same reason, they don't want to be held accountable themselves.
Yep. Yep. All right, guys, I'm going to shake it all loose, get rid of the elections a little bit, and move on to the last couple of episodes. We've looked at a couple of fails or things that gone wrong when it comes to either a global expansion or in a particular field. And I was just looking at some trademark fails. Now, Zan, you're a trademark IP lawyer. I want to see if any of these make you cringe, but do you guys know what a finger spinner? No, a
fidget.
Fidget spinner. Not a fidget spinner is that thing.
Yeah.
I must admit, just to bet, Al Ben is a big believer in the Segway. I think Trump has a fidget spinner, and that's what he does most of the day when he's not tweeting. He sits there and goes. But the interesting thing with the fidget spinner is it was someone came up with it in the 90s, and they tried to make a business out of it, and it really didn't go anywhere, and it kind of pretty much failed. And they had patented this idea, and then the patent came up for renewal, and she just didn't pay the fee for it. And she had forgotten to pay the fee for the fidget spinner. And then someone picked it up in an age of social media, and it just boomed. And I don't know if I can, it's not massive money, but she basically lost out on $2.6 million because that's basically how this thing just blew up, and everyone was having fidget spinners all over the place. And she could have been getting a little bit of a taste of that. Is it as strict as that? I've had this IP, this trademark. I forget to pay the license, the fee, and I'm gone. I'm out.
Did the other person pick up the patent? Sorry, is that it?
No, I think it was just.
No, it doesn't work.
So anyone can then make it. Yeah. Oh, how does it work, Zen?
So with a patent, or depends how you want to pronounce it. You apply, you can only get it with strict criteria. I won't go into those, I want to bore everybody. But when you get granted one, it only lasts for 20 years. So if you said she did this in the 90s, I don't know when fidget spinners blew up, but from
a couple years ago,
it's only in the last few years.
Yeah, so 1997 was when I think she had the patent. Yeah.
Okay, so 2017. So it would have come to an end pretty much at the point where it's blown up anyway. And the whole point with patents is they protect inventions. And it's capped at 20 years with annual renewal opportunities. If you don't renew, it kind of lapses, because it's meant to reward innovation, but then not hinder competition. So if you let somebody have a patent for something forever, it kind of hinders other people working on that invention, that technology, that idea, making it better. So they're thinking, where's the balance between rewarding people for the kind of creativity versus competitiveness? So I guess if she did lose out because she didn't want to pay the renewal fees, that's... I mean, people make so many mistakes with IP. If you don't, there's probably bigger ones with letting patents lapse or trademarks, you know, costly rebrands. There's all sorts of disasters. I guess if she sat at home thinking, oh, I lost myself potentially 2.6 million, that would hurt.
I think that was $2.6 million just in April 2017. I just checked my notes now. It's probably more that, because if it went so big just here in little South Africa, I can only imagine it's everywhere in the world. In China, like a billion kids are kind of spinning the fidget spinners, you know. I just find that part of it fascinating. You spoke about interesting kind of trademarks. Ben, can you take a sip of your coffee quickly, because I'm about to go into talking about Starbucks. Let's just, are you drinking a Frappuccino or Heinekeno or something?
Heinekeno, yeah.
He's got like a Heineken in his coffee mug, but we won't hold that
for this early morning coffee we're having.
You have to censor it. They haven't paid for advertising.
Yeah. I don't think the Looney Tunes have either, so.
No product placement.
Starbucks sued New York Coffee Company a while back. For the name New York, I find this fascinating, but New York Coffee Company came up with the name Fredocino, and because it's too close to Frappuccino, Starbucks sued them for infringement on that. Do you think that? I mean, do you hear some of this stuff in Silicon Valley or wherever around the world?
First question, Ben, what's a Fredocino?
Do you know what a Fredocino is?
The only thing that comes to my mind is Godfather 2. I have no clue what a Fredocino could be. Maybe they kiss you when you order the Fredocino.
not in pre-COVID, I would think.
Yeah, probably not.
But again, it's interesting that, I mean, Starbucks makes a couple of billion dollars off their Frappuccinos. So the case is a lot more. I must admit, I didn't think that. And then again, to you, but do you have to take a trademark for everything on their menu? Then are you telling me that?
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Is their trademark actually for? I thought Frappuccino was a type of drink. I didn't know it was a Starbucks thing. Maybe that's where it is. Starbucks have made it, I think.
They've made it a thing. I think that's what the story that I found on a legal kind of thing about interesting IP trademark fails and cases.
Yeah. So a trademark is a sign of origin. So if someone so you name something and you want people to associate it with you, you can trademark it. So with a menu, you can't trademark coffee or, you know, juice, because loads of people want to sell coffee and juice. And if they can't write coffee and juice on their menu, then they're stuffed. So you can only trademark something that is, it can't either be descriptive, and it's got to be, it's got to stand out in some way. So I couldn't open up a butcher's and call it butchers and trademark that. It'd have to be, I'd have to name it, I don't know, Caligari meat. I could get away with that because it doesn't, no one else would necessarily call it that.
Not that I would give you a trademark. You have to negotiate that first.
Yeah. Well, it depends. You register first to
you
file.
You can't trademark your name, right? You can't.
You can't normally trademark name. You can. There's an own name defense. So let's say I set up Caligari meat for some reason, and then Ben decided to set up his own version. I couldn't then go and sue him and say, "Yo, I've got the trademark for this." He's like, "Well, it's my name." So tough luck. So there is an own name defense. There's kind of more nuances to it, but yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I believe Sarah Palin, who was running for vice president at one stage, she did the whole application to trademark her name and then forgot to sign the papers. And then, I mean, that doesn't that just say everything right there? One more on this trademark thing is that there was a case where, you know, GoDaddy, the internet site that kind of you can go and secure URLs and domain names. GoDaddy was they spoke about there was a case where the Academy Awards were suing GoDaddy for infringement of their copyright because they allowed people to do some cyber squatting on things like you could take the URL 2011 Academy Awards. And then 2012 Academy Awards, and they you could cyber squat on that, and then they actually GoDaddy actually won because and so therefore I feel that's quite a huge thing because that means I can go and get any URL that's close to some big competitor and play around with that. What are your thoughts on that, guys?
It might vary because I'm pretty sure that PlayStation just won a case recently. And again, this is, don't quote me on it, but someone bought the URLs PS5, PS6, PS7, PS8, you know, obviously anticipating each model just increasing because they followed the same name dynamic, whereas obviously Xbox has varied. But I think they won. So that's more of a, this is obviously connected to our thing. I don't know. I'd have to go double check on that, but I think it might just slightly depend a little bit on the wording.
I think it depends on why you've registered that domain name. So cyber squatting, I'm pretty sure, is illegal. So you can't buy a domain name because you just want to sit on it and hope the person whose brand it relates to will pay you out for it. But trademark protects your brand against specific things. You can't just have a trademark for everything. So McDonald's is protected against fast food. Obviously, when you get super big, your name gets a bit broader protection, but you protect it against a specific thing. So when you register domain names, I don't go on a website that I've never heard of. I might not know what that relates to. So you can't, so trademark protection for domain names, it exists, but it's a bit narrower. So with something like the Academy Awards, I mean, I guess everyone would probably think of the Oscars. So they'd probably have a strong-ish case. I'm guessing it was a contentious, hotly contested result. But with something like that, if they didn't try and buy it, if they don't even want the name and GoDaddy's just got it there, they're not using it to have a go at the brand. They're not saying you can't buy it. And they're just sat there. Then I can kind of see why there's no issues with it. If they were using it and saying, pretending to be the Oscars and getting people coming to them and getting ad revenue because people thought it was the actual Oscars website, that would be different. If it's just a empty page with some ads on it and not, the Oscars haven't tried to buy it, then, you know, don't see the problem.
Seems like intelligent.
Maybe Maybe the academies tried to sue the wrong people because they're suing GoDaddy, and all GoDaddy did was, hey, I just provide URLs. I don't want to do anything with this URL. Someone else has just bought it from me. You know, but I think the Academy Awards probably wanted to go for a bigger target to actually get something. But then,
although GoDaddy's probably more likely got money versus whoever bought 2011 Academy Awards. It's probably somebody trying to make a quick buck, so they've probably got nothing to sue them for.
Yep. So the last thing, and it's kind of on the trademark fails, and it kind of, and I wasn't going to mention it. It's not part of what I mentioned to you guys, but then I saw the four of us, and it made me think of, did you guys watch the movie The Hangover?
Yeah.
And so the if I see of us, I'm just trying to think who's who in the movie. The
Hangover. Yeah, who's getting the tattoo?
Yeah,
I think you're getting the tattoo, Taraj.
And it's exactly that. It's about the tattoo, right? Because in the movie, the one dude gets a face tattoo that's exactly like Mike Tyson. And the tattoo artist that tattooed Mike Tyson had put a copyright on that design and sued the movie and nearly prevented the movie from being released because he was saying that's an infringement of his copyright. I mean, I just find that the most bizarre thing.
That's why you got to be smart. You never know when it's going to come in handy. Trademark your stuff. Could be 2 years from now. Could be tomorrow that someone tries to do something with it, even by chance or on purpose. So if in doubt, trademark, protect, copyright.
So I wonder how many people can you imagine the weird things that are being trademarked now? If that dude trademarked a tattoo design, how many other people are like taking pictures of their butts and kind of going, please, patent office, can we please trademark this? You know, it is fairly bizarre.
Just to clarify for anyone watching, patents, trademarks, and copyright are all three different things, so they're not interchangeable. But nonetheless, in this place, copyright protects artwork or creative things. Could be sounds, could be written, could be visual. So I guess in this case, you know, the whole point of it is to protect someone who's created something. He probably spent hours and hours doing that design if he's done it custom made and done it for Mike Tyson. So if a studio is going to go and make a film and use that design, then for him, he's like, well, I've spent ages doing this and I've got an opportunity here because it is Mike Tyson. Might as well try and make some money from it.
He did actually, it was settled out of court. So that makes me feel like he got something out of this.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's the States. That's what you do, right? You sue someone, settle outside of court, money goes everywhere.
That's how we do it. There's one very interesting documentary I've been meaning to watch sort of on this topic called Feels Good Man. I don't know if any of you have heard of it, but essentially it follows the artist Matt Fury, who was the creator of the Pepe the Frog symbol that I'm sure you all have seen show up, you know, sort of sprung from the dark corners of the internet to represent you know, white nationalism, you know, the Trump administration and all various like manner of things, and the sort of creator's quest to try to reclaim his art with whatever way he could and reframe it around the things that it was originally intended, as well as following along some of the folks at these sort of boards like 4chan, where these memes sort of take over the landscape. Super interested to hear about. I've heard it's really great and definitely goes into the sort of journey of what happens when art that you've put a lot of time and intent and energy into with an expectation to be received in a certain light is taken completely out of proportion and in ways that are unexpected and almost impossible to stop. So definitely would recommend checking that out.
That has to be an interesting way to look at it, though, because I can understand his issue with that. But
guys, I'm going to jump a little bit to carry on, Ben. Sorry.
That's all right. I think there might have just been a slight delay there. I was just going to say that's very interesting because how people interpret art and take that away, if it's a positive thing, that's what you want to happen with art eventually, right? It's obviously unfortunate that white supremacists decided that's going to be part of their thing, but I can imagine that. Yeah, sounds quite interesting.
It's a bit like the swastika. So I'm not 100% clear on the origins, but I know it features in Hinduism. And then that's obviously existed for thousands of years. And then the Nazis came along and started using it. And I remember watching a Bollywood movie once and the symbol was there. And for the first half a second, I was like, oh, and I was like, oh, no. And I think a lot of people who didn't know that or don't know that will probably react differently. So that's, that kind of shows the negative connotations that can happen when someone takes your, takes something, a symbol or artwork.
So I want to jump to GitLabs. I think that's how you say it. GitLabs is a company, and is a company that has recently been evaluated at $2.8 billion. It has 1,300 staff members all around the world, and they have never had, and they still don't have, an office. Never. The entire business of that size is built work from home. And Ben, you were saying now that you're not in Silicon Valley, you're with your family during lockdown. How has it been picked up and taken in the States? So people, is it just part of the, become the norm? Do you think this whole work from anywhere, work from home is here to stay?
It's a good question. Certainly for white collar workers, it does appear like the big sort of main tech companies have been setting the tone, it seems, for how long they're allowing people to work remotely, if they put any caps on it at all. I believe Twitter suggested that the folks can work remotely, you know, forever. Facebook probably has theirs till sometime in the middle towards the end of next year. My company is not having us go back into the office, at least now, until July. I think companies are probably going to take a look at how much they're spending on whatever real estate they're occupying in, you know, very expensive locations like Mexico or Silicon Valley, and question whether it makes sense for them, assuming that they feel they can wring the productivity out of their workers as they normally would under the watchful eye of whatever management they have there. But it seems like most of those companies have not felt in any way required to do that. So who knows? It's so hard to predict anything that goes on that's pandemic related. But it seems like there's certainly a possibility that some of these companies might just say, yeah, forget it. Like, we'll just, you know, we'll have a headquarters here, maybe have one or two, you know, main staff here, and then everyone else will hire from everywhere. And at least at the company I work at now, Code for America, it's been a great benefit to be able to hire people outside of San Francisco, because it allows us to hire people that do not want to live in a city that is one of the most unaffordable in the country. We have a much wider array of talent we can bring in, much more diverse group of people and backgrounds and mindsets. So I think it's been good for us. I personally prefer being in an office. That's just how I work better. But I think overall, assuming we can sort of gel with this remote, all remote lifestyle, I think it will be a positive thing.
Yep. I think that whole finding talent anywhere and is a big thing. I mean, we've got there's also a part of what GitLab does is it allows everyone to that I think they've got their salaries. Even their salaries are based on a whole lot of different depending on where you are as well. So there's cost savings on a couple of levels there. Ben and Zane, your thoughts? I mean, I think, Ben, you've been working with Centuro for about 8 months and have been to the office twice, right?
Yeah, I think that was it. I think I went in a couple of times to get the aircon when we had a little bit of 1 week heat wave here in London. I popped in there, but luckily there was barely anyone around, and obviously I was outside of lockdown and so forth. Lockdown one of two. Yeah, I mean, I think it makes sense. I think one of the problems that we technology faces and companies face is obviously like entrenched legacy systems, processes, ways of working, and so forth. So I can imagine if you decide that from the start, building a company to 1,300 employees without an office would be a lot easier than if you're a company with hundreds of people and then you try to switch. Obviously, I think a lot of people then, you know, so one of the benefits of COVID is it accelerated a lot of people who were maybe anti-online meetings and anti-work from home and just kind of forced them to adapt a bit to the technology. But I can see the benefit because back in August, Pinterest were in the process of building like a massive headquarters, I think somewhere in Silicon Valley or somewhere, and they pulled out of it, pulled out of the contract, and pulling out of the contract cost them $90 million, but that they were set to pay like $490 million in office or something. And they're just like, in the new way of working, we'll take this $90 million hit because it'll save us hundreds of millions and we'll just adapt to a work from home. So I can imagine. I'm looking forward to us eventually being in an office, but I just think the way it's going to happen is going to be a lot more sort of, you know, we work focused. Let's pick one and we'll meet up there. We've all got a hot desk seat. We can go in and out when we want, but we'll meet on Thursdays to get the benefit of being in the same space to have the sort of creativity sessions. So I think it makes sense. I think it's obviously a good achievement from them, but they've been able to do it, set it from the start and build processes around it. I think that will be the trick for anybody in trying to replicate that sort of approach. But I think, yeah, it makes sense. I think that there's a lot of money to be saved in doing it.
Yeah, I agree with Ben there. I mean, I think we've discussed it on previous episodes, but there's a lot of benefits. There's obviously pros and cons to working from home. And I think depending on your industry, where you can work from home full time, I think most of those sorts of businesses will probably shift to a model where you don't have to go to the office every day. A lot of people were already doing, you can work from home one day a week before the pandemic started in certain companies. But I think it's now going to come to a point where it's a case of you can choose. So do you want to work 3 days in the week in the office? Do you want it to be two? Do you want it to be one? And I think there is still a lot to be said for working in an office, having that kind of teamwork environment, brainstorming ideas, bouncing them off. Oh, you want to ask a question, the person's just over there. And not even just that, from a health perspective, I found I barely walk as many steps a day. I don't get enough exercise, you know, compared to just the commute. And then when you're at work, I know we've been in lockdowns or, you know, nervous times about socializing, but even by being out, I'm more likely to think, oh yeah, I'll meet up with a friend and go do X, Y, Z after work. Whereas when you're at home, you're like, well, I'm at home, I don't, 6, 7 PM. I don't want to get ready and go out now. So even that small random element, I think everyone's different. Everyone's got different priorities. I think we will definitely go back to a point where I think the office is still important, but it become a lot more flexible. And I think even to the point where it's up to the employees themselves rather than office policy, you have to be in the office 3-4 days a week, unless you have specific meetings or specific, you know, things you need to discuss. But I think generally speaking, it will be a lot more flexible.
They were saying that the GitLab CEO has a treadmill desk. So I mean, I know I'm sitting too much, so I'm trying to raise my entire setup a little bit higher so I can stand occasionally. But he has the treadmill desk, and then I was on a meeting today with someone who was actually on a treadmill, and they're literally walking while they're talking to you as they're going along. They're drinking the coffee, but they're constantly walking.
That seems unnecessary. Yeah.
I've had meetings with people that have been on those before, and I've just been like, "What? I'm sorry, this is too ridiculous. Like, I can't do anything that's going on seriously when you're just like getting like 5 mph. Sorry, I don't know, 3 km/h.
Did you ask them to stop? Did you guys? Can you please stop walking?
No, that's even more awkward. Let him
shoot off the back.
Got the green walk, red walk sign. Just turn it on.
Yeah.
Talk about things that happen at home in your new home office. The story that caught my eye this morning was that a journalist from the New Yorker was fired for exposing himself on a Zoom meeting. It's one thing to have like sexual misconduct or misconduct in general in an office. It's unacceptable. There's big Me Too movements and everything else. But to get fired when you are in your home, that is at another level of failure, in my opinion.
I'm assuming this is an accident, right? He hasn't exposed himself on purpose on the Zoom meeting. It's not been I'm going to get it out to show the world. It's been a accidental, the camera's still rolling, I didn't realize. I'm assuming.
I don't know if any of you read this story, and I'm trying to see how much of this I can say without it getting cut later on. But he was on a group meeting and he took another call, thought he had muted and put his camera off, but then the camera moved to show that he was not a, like that he was naked and touching himself while he was meeting. I mean, that is taking it to another level. It's just at another level.
I don't want Zoom fails to go away, because they've some of the compilations on YouTube and stuff have been excellent entertainment to see people step back in their underwear and go, oh crap, and jump for the camera and try to turn it off and so forth. But
until you make that mistake.
I imagine at some level you just have to be professional. Like, what? There shouldn't even be a chance that happens, essentially.
Zen looks, he's got a look. Zen, you got a look on your face that says, I'm not wearing pants. That's what you're saying.
No, definitely am.
I'm not wearing shoes, but that's become my new norm. It's summer here now, and I can kind of wear flops and kind of barefoot and everything else. And I've loved it. I mean, I haven't worn kind of like smart shoes that I used to wear for ages. You know, it's just since this whole work from home thing. And it's just, I must admit, I'm loving it. I'm enjoying it. But what are some of the challenges that you guys have faced? Ben, I know you've moved recently homes. You've had kind of some room issues and things like that. I've had my biggest challenges are my kids, right? So working from home when you have a 6-year-old and a 10-year-old is really tough, because when they get home from school, all they want to do is be on you. That for me has been the toughest thing of working from home.
Yeah,
Ben, your challenges.
Well, yeah, one of the benefits of me just recently moving, and that's why I don't have a fake background on it anymore, what we used to on Zoom, is that we specifically now have an office space in the flat. So eventually there'll be some sort of entertainment up here just to fill in the background a little bit and to make it a good background, but that's hanging photos is coming. So that's been super helpful. I would say I have enjoyed having to go to a professional meeting and just chucking on a shirt. And I'll be wearing shorts or tracksuit pants down below. Today I'm actually fairly well dressed. I have enjoyed just the 5 minutes before needing to be somewhere or to be on camera. Just into the cupboard, on goes the business shirt. I've got those ones where you don't have to iron them, so I don't have to worry about that. On goes the shirt and I'm all good, but I'm shorts and a pair of socks down here. And then as soon as the meeting's over, off that goes and comes back on the tee. So I'm never in a position where I'm going to accidentally stand up and I'll be in my underwear. I haven't gone that far into the comfort realm. Maybe luckily because it's cold here in the UK. But I have enjoyed it.
And other Ben, what are your dislikes and likes of working from home?
I will say working from this particular home, I'm at my mother's house. She's cooking great. I'm really appreciative of that. I am pretty holed up here. Is sort of what Zan was saying before, like just the problem of being in your house all the time and you don't have the momentum of leaving your house to go do other things or see other people. I do find that like kind of puts a dent in some other stuff that I think I might be doing otherwise if I had that sort of momentum. But other than that, I'm pretty used to it. I've worked from home from jobs before and in plenty of situations. So this isn't too new for me. I do miss the camaraderie of being in an office environment and just having a relationship with my coworkers. I started my job, as I mentioned to you guys before that we started, about mid-March, just about when San Francisco had locked down. So I haven't really met any of my coworkers, which is kind of a strange thing. And normally, even when we had remote coworkers in the past prior to COVID, there was a quarterly meeting that they would bring everyone to, so everyone would get the chance to sort of get to know each other a little better. And I do find that we have to really go out of our way a little more as our organization grows. And as I mentioned, we have more and more remote employees that aren't going to be in San Francisco to just make social time to just get to know each other better. Not only does it just make the work more enjoyable. I think you just get a better sense of where folks are coming from, even in the work context. Other than that, I think it enables you to open yourself to, you know, good faith and just a little bit better ease of understanding in those other contexts. I did want to say something briefly about the Jeffrey Toobin story. I think it is hilarious. It's just, it's got to be, it was a really fun treat to have in the midst of all the election news to hear that Jeffrey Toobin showed his tube to all his coworkers. But I think the only interesting thing that I can come up with about this that I think is still worth mentioning is when we think about situations like this in a workplace, and as we've all been mentioning, now our workplace has been moved away from the place of work, and now it's now everywhere. There is a lot of implications about the way these things are handled with labor law. And when you think about a guy like Jeffrey Toobin, you know, he's a longtime writer, been around for forever, he has some opinions that I disagree with. I was happy to see him go, but I don't believe that we should be, because we, and at least in the United States, most places have at-will employment, your employer really can basically take anything as an excuse to fire you. And there's definitely something, we want to look at how, even though it's applied in this very hilarious case, I think it's important to think about how that can be applied in the case of the you know, lowest common denominator worker, someone at Walmart who may like to try to come up with maybe a similar instance. Perhaps like he's looking at some like personal pictures on his phone, a coworker comes by and sees him looking at that, or a manager comes by and sees him looking at that. Should that person be allowed to be fired immediately, or not be told, or not at least have a chance to say, hey, that's not appropriate. Please don't bring those things up at work, and have an opportunity to improve upon it. I think it is, it's something we should consider because there are folks that when these things are applied in this way, always receive the worst end of it. So that's the only interesting, I would say, thing about this, other than just the hilarity factor, which is very high.
Although there is a line, surely, a common sense line. So it's like you said, so now the workplace isn't the physical workplace, it's anywhere. So if you're at home and you know there's a meeting going on, you've got your camera on, whether you turn it off or not, you know at that moment it's a professional environment. Doesn't matter the fact that you're all in different places. So you can't behave in a certain way where if you get caught out, and if it's televised on your screen, on your camera, on your computer to even one person, let alone groups of people, isn't exposing yourself a criminal offense anyway in public? So just because you're at home.
Is this in public?
Yeah.
I don't know. But I think, I think it's an important question. Like, I think that we should just always think about how these things are applied in either end of the spectrum of these circumstances and how they generally negatively affect the most vulnerable people. Not Jeffrey Toobin, certainly, but it's worthy of thinking about.
I mean, you have to kind of think, what was he doing when it wasn't COVID in his office behind his door? So again, if you had walked in on him in his office, is that a fireable offense? And then, you know, he could say, but it's my office, I can do whatever I want to you.
The company owns the office. It's not his at that point, isn't it? Surely. Yeah.
But I just think you just don't want to be hard on him. Because he was doing that all by himself. But anyway, on that bombshell, we'll move on from Mr. Tuba or whatever. But I think I'm happy to leave it there, guys. This is it's been fun having you here, Ben Caligari. Lovely to have a guest from Silicon Valley. I was so lucky to spend some time in San Jose and at San Jose University, see the place, meet the people of Silicon Valley. It's a beautiful, beautiful part of the world. And I wish to visit there again. But thanks for joining us in our coffee. I think other Ben in London, your coffee has been special today.
Yeah.
But in general, I think it's been fun. Lovely to have you. Thank you, everyone, for watching. And let's see you in the next episode. This has been...
Maybe we'll have an election result by the next one. We said that last time. We'll finish counting.
We'll get right on.
Okay.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Yeah.